Hi, I'm Nick Rigoretti's, and this is the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast, the show for grapplers and martial artists that want to evolve both on and off the mat. Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Show episode number 31 is about to start. Before we get going, I just want to remind you guys, the coupon code PODCAST will get you 10% off anything at our store, which can be found at store.jiu-jitsubrother.com. And I wanted to ask you guys, if you're enjoying the show, please leave a review on iTunes. It not only encourages us, but helps us appear higher in the charts, which means more people listen, which makes it better for us, which means I'm going to make more shows. So please go on to iTunes and leave a review. So next guest is one of the people I've known for the longest since I've been doing jiu-jitsu. His name's Oliver Geddes, and he's also a black belt under Roger. Lovely man, interesting guy, super intelligent, as you're about to hear. And he's got some pretty good insight on jiu-jitsu. So here we go, episode number 31, Ollie Geddes. Enjoy. Hey guys, welcome to the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Show. And today's guest is a longtime friend and training partner of mine. Someone who I consider to be one of the best human beings, not just in jiu-jitsu, but walking the earth today. He is a legend in the competition scene. In England especially, you cannot go to a jiu-jitsu gym without hearing his name whispered in reverence and awe. There's none other than my close friend and Roger Gracie black belt, Oliver Geddes. Ollie, how are you, my brother?
I'm a little bit sick, but I'm otherwise good. And I'm not really sure I can live up to an introduction like that. But thank you very much for having me.
It's good to have you on. Now, you are currently in Surbiton, which is... Yep. Tell me your story. Are you originally from which part of England?
I'm originally from around here, to be honest. Just sort of southwest London. Southwest okay. of London, suburbs, whatever. Yeah, just a smallish town village down that way, which didn't have a whole lot going on. Boarding school, a few other things about it. Didn't spend a whole lot of time down that way.
You went to boarding school? I didn't know that about you.
Yeah, 13 to 18, legit British boarding school, uniforms, tweed jackets, all the real stuff.
Wow, that sounds... I'm just picturing that video game Bully. Do you remember that from a few years ago?
I do, just about, yeah. It's as schools went, it had a bit of a nice Harry Potter vibe. It was lots of old architecture in the middle of the countryside. But that's sort of where you kind of went. It was like, if you wanted to go to a good school, you went to a boarding school in that was a little bit up its own backside. But It was a good experience, and it gets you out of the house. It gives you a bit of, you're not just living at home and doing whatever, but, So that was up until I was like 18, university in London. And then, thought I'd dabble in this jiu-jitsu thing. I'd give it a go, on like a post university gap year, and started training and never actually stopped. So on the longest gap year ever right now, but,
Well, that's not entirely true, because you didn't start with jiu-jitsu when it comes to your martial arts career. You were doing something before. You want to share that with us? Let's get it out in the open so we can move through it.
I've done various things, but, my first thing that I started training at university was, Wing Chun. Which, to be fair, most people did, I think, because it has that always important Bruce Lee connection, because when I was growing up, you know, Bruce Lee movies were where it was at. So I did a couple of years of Wing Chun at university, and it was an experience, and I learned a few things from it, but I tried a whole bunch of other martial arts after that, and I just found that jiu-jitsu allowed you to actually pressure test and to actually work on everything you were learning in like a fairly realistic environment, which as much as wearing pajamas, you know, is, but you know what I mean, much more realistic. And you got to spar, you got to train, and you got to know whether what you were learning was going to work. And you know, after a whole bunch of schools that discourage sparring, you know, at the gate, because they don't want guys going crazy or hitting each other or anything else, or you get like 4 minutes in a 2-hour class to pressure test, and then you walk in and you're doing 45 minutes sparring on your first day. It was a big change, and it's what really sort of attracted me to the whole art, really. It was that you could pressure test and you could do it, you could train hard and never really get hurt too badly. So that was yeah, that was what made it stand out compared to everything else.
And when did you realize that you were gonna make this a large part of your life, and it was gonna develop into a career for you? Or was that just an accident? Did it just kind of progress that
It
way?
kind of just flowed that way, I guess. I thought I'd give it a year to try it out, and to try just martial arts and stuff before I decided what I really wanted to do or what I had to do, because I wasn't thinking, oh, I'll just train for a year and then I'll make a career out of this. How hard could it be? I mean, everyone would come and pay me and train with me if I've been training for a year hard. No, I never really thought that. So yeah, basically I sorry. I just thought I'd give it the year. I burned through all my savings in that year, and I began getting a few odd jobs around the academy that were just supposed to sort of keep me going. And I don't know, really, it just kind of, I never got to the point where I went, well, I really need to get a proper job now because I have no money whatsoever. I always flirted around that line of complete bankruptcy, which allowed me to sort of maintain things from there. I got close to running out a lot of times, but I was just, well, I'm going to do this. I'm going to carry on doing this. And I never got to the point where I went, maybe I shouldn't be doing this, I never went, well, I'm going to do this in 5 years' time. It was just, I'm going to do this as long as I can. And I'm going to do everything I can to make that possible. And a lot of things fell my way. And I ended up being able to carry it all through around brown belt, which was about 4 or 5 years in. At that point, you're kind of at an instructor level. People, you're kind of held up as somebody who you can make a career out of it. And that's basically what I did. I sort of struggled through until I got to brown, and then began teaching, broke even a little bit, and then, yeah, hit the big black belt. And it's just been, I was able to keep it running the whole way through somehow. So
That's cool.
I've been very lucky, but yeah.
That's great, Ollie. Yeah, I think it's equal parts luck and hard work. I wanted to speak to you a bit about your approach to training. I had a big debate with Kit Dale a few weeks ago about I don't want to say it was concepts versus drilling, because that would imply that I don't agree with concepts, or I don't place an emphasis on concepts, which is not true. I really think they're vital. It was more concepts versus concepts plus drilling. And you're one of the reasons I don't entirely believe in the notion of just sparring and doing nothing but working things out on the fly. Because I remember you were like, I don't want to say you were not good, but you were pretty average. And then I remember there was a point where you went away and studied Eddie Bravo's 10th Planet Half Guard lockdown system, and you literally, that was all you did. You studied that and then came to class and tried to implement it. And you made this massive jump in ability. It was night and day. It was like you went from being an average dude to being a really skilled jiu-jitsu player. And I attribute that to the fact that you were using a very linear, very specific system. What are your thoughts? Do you still train like that? Do you agree with what I've said? Can you share a bit about your approach to jiu-jitsu training?
Just a quick thing. I mean, the whole 10th Planet thing, again, at the time that was sort of 2006, 2007, I guess. There really wasn't any instructionals or anything you could find that really gave you a system. It was the vast majority of things. There probably may be some exceptions, but that I had access to back then, everything was just a grab bag of techniques. You'd have some guy who'd sort of go, okay guys, we're going to work from the mount. Here's how you do the arm bar. Here's how you do the choke. I show you my favorite sweep. And there was never a real structure to the whole thing. Obviously things have got a whole lot better since then. There's way more like full comprehensive guides to positions or whatever. But at the time, I wanted something to hang a structure on, and there wasn't anything there until I remember I read the first Eddie Bravo book, Jiu Jitsu Unleashed, which was not really particularly good. It was poorly explained, and not I mean, there's a whole Eddie's gone into talking about why there was a publishing issue with it. But then he released Mastering the Rubber Guard, which was the first, it was a book you could carry around. It was X hundred pages. It gave you a complete system of guard play and how it all fit together. And that's basically what I started with, because half guard more than anything else is something that you can pretty much always get to. It has very, very limited prerequisites. You know, you don't need to be flexible to do it. You don't need to be strong. You don't need to be, you know, able to get even to any really good position. You can get there in one step from pretty much everywhere. You know, if you're in close guard and they start passing, you end up in half guard. If you're in if you get mounted, you trap their foot, you end up in half guard. So it was a very simple system which you could apply from pretty much anywhere, and that's pretty much what allowed me to implement it into my game a whole lot quicker, because I never considered myself particularly athletic or coordinated or anything else. And I think if you checked, Eddie would probably say the same, in all honesty, barring his ludicrous flexibility. And yeah, I think it was just a system where you could shut down the options the other person has, and control the fight that way, rather than having to fall back on your own attributes or anything else. I mean, even the rubber guard stuff, I was never super flexible, but it doesn't require as much flexibility as he has, or some of the more unnatural people do. But yeah, that's why I started with what I did. Anything I've kind of added to that over time, again, I'm not big on drilling in general. People have their own feelings on that. But my main thing is that I think certain things have to be drilled, but not everything. So movements that, you know, will have to be done instinctively, will have to be done over and over again. It's possible you can develop it during mat time, but you're going to speed that process up massively by drilling a few certain things. Again, things like if you're passing someone's guard and they turn to their knees, the ability to spin to their back and things like that. You can't just go, well, I know what I'm going to do, because your body has to do it before you decide to do it. So that things like that, which are some guard passing drills and things where you want to just go. But I think other things where you have more of a sense of control, more of a sense of, you know, where you can take your grips, you can take your time, and then you can make your movements happen. Those don't need to be drilled quite so much. You can have an understanding, or you can just rep it a few times and then feel how it should be and be done with it. You don't have to, you know, drill it over and over and over again, because, you know, you don't have to. You can react consciously rather than unconsciously, if that makes sense.
Okay, that makes total sense.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you basically, I would say you mastered that 10th Planet half guard system. Did you then move on to another system, or how did your game develop from there?
It started off with that, but I think it's kind of hard to describe. Basically, I mean, the classical 10th Planet system, and Eddie's thing across there with the lockdown and everything else, is very strong, but it's also slightly inflexible in terms of how but basically it's a case of taking the position, dominating it, and not allowing the person on top to really react to it. You know, you have the lockdown, you have control over their knee, their hips, their foot and everything, and then you use that positioning and you set your sweeps up and everything else. Whereas I loosen things up a little bit, so I had to be more aware of different reactions the other person can make, because again, 10th Planet limits the reactions the person can do, so which is a good thing, I'm not gonna lie, but it does mean that when you loosen things up a little bit, there will always be things the person on top can do, particularly from half guard, where you don't have full body control, you don't have, like, you know, a body triangle or close guard. They will always have a way that they can move that you have to be able to react to. Again, the lockdown does limit that, but if you're just controlling other ways, they can choose to put their weight one way or the other, and you're going to have the correct reaction to that because of the nature of their body weight and the lack of full control over their body. So so basically, then as I loosened things up, I had to have answers more to what the person was choosing to do. So if they chose to go one way, then I would, well, how can I take advantage of the fact they're going this way, and so on and so forth. And again, 10th Planet is the same thing, but I think it kept it to, at least the lockdown system kept it to a narrower lens, whereas I think because I was looser a little bit with it, I had to have a few more options. So I began sort of finding different pegs to fit different holes and trying to adjust things from there. That was the half guard game. Yeah. And then things like how do you deal with half guard? But a half guard if the person stands up completely. It's almost impossible to play full half guard in a standing opponent. And so because of that, I added in some X guards, some single leg X, mostly through Legato, actually, who was teaching at Rogers for a while, and just finding a system that would allow you to go from playing half guard to playing you know, something on a standing opponent that gave them different pressures, different things they had to worry about, whilst at the same time still integrating into your half guard game, which was pretty much the standard development. And then in the end, you develop a top game because, again, to begin with, you start out, if you're a guard player, you never have much of a top game. You know, you try and sweep, you try and get to a good position. And then as you train on, just the little things fall together and you find a passing system that works for you. But that took a lot longer. I mean, I had basically no passing game at all until like purple. And then around brown, I gained like 15 kilograms, which helped an awful lot when it came to the top game thing.
That's
when,
something yeah. else I wanted to talk to you about is yeah. You remember when I met you, a reasonably, I don't want to say skinny guy, but you were definitely not, I remember you, when you talk about stack guys, you use the term ridged. You weren't ridged back in the day.
okay. Yeah.
And then we all turned around one day and it wasn't like skinny Ollie anymore. It was like ridged Ollie. And how did that happen? I spoke to our mutual friend Mark and he remember him telling me, he said you just attributed it to drinking milk, but I know there's got to be more to it than that. Can you explain
part
to
of
me?
It. But okay, basically no. I decided that I was a little bit too small for lightweight. I've always felt, because when I was a lightweight back then, I believe it or not, at like 5'9", I wasn't super tall, but I was, you know, average to tallish at lightweight. And so I basically, in things like, again, when half guard is relatively upper body strength focused and, you know, being lanky is not super helpful in certain cases, I just felt that small tanky people were kind of beating me up a bit. So I basically decided I was going to go to the gym, I was going to lift some weights, and I was going to gain some strength, a little bit of mass. So I began going to the gym 3 days a week, just like a full body squats program, whatever. But the problem is, when you're training jiu-jitsu full time, and you're doing, you know, at my peak, it was like 10 sessions a week. But even on a lazy week, it was like 6 or 7. It's incredibly hard to gain weight. I mean, my metabolism isn't so bad, but when you add jiu-jitsu to it, you know, it just takes all the weight off you. So I needed a ton of calories to bump it up. So I basically drank a whole ton of chocolate milk because, because for whatever reason, I'm not a big fan of just guzzling milk by itself. I needed something to make it palatable if you're going to be drinking literally liters of it. So I began drinking 3 or 4 liters of chocolate milk a day, which sounds ridiculous, but is actually accurate. I think I settled on 3 in the end because I tried 4, which is the traditional gallon of milk a day thing. But my digestion couldn't handle it, we'll say delicately. So we settled on 3 liters a day, and the body could just about handle that combined with training.
And your protocol for your, I think you still follow it to this day, when it comes to weightlifting, you just stick to the basic lifts like deadlift, bench press, and squat, or what are you doing when
much.
It comes to
yeah.
it?
That's been standard. Standard full body things. Overhead bench. Back at the original program, I was doing some power cleans and some other stuff, but some weighted chin ups, weighted pull ups that don't think get enough love, but they're really good, you know, exercise for, again, developing strength and, you know, grip strength, endurance, some other things at the same time. But yeah, nothing super fancy. We're not doing, you know, thousand reps on machines and, you know, curls and everything else. Just the big lifts, particularly because back then when it was combined with full-time jiu-jitsu training, your body couldn't handle doing 1,000, you know, the volume of doing a ton of other things just didn't work out. So you had to do, you know, your big lifts, go in, get everything done in like an hour and a half, and then just get out. There wasn't really you're already pushing myself pretty hard to try and balance the lifting and the training at the same time. In the end, what I had to do was I had to separate the I had to have a lifting day and a training day. Once it began getting really heavy, particularly because I was squatting most days, I'd do 1 day lifting and then double jiu-jitsu the next day, 1 day lifting, double jiu-jitsu. So I ended up doing 6-7 sessions a week with 3 hard lifting sessions, just because it drained me too much to try and do both together. Maybe I could have balanced that better, but I didn't go too crazy on it. But a lot of squatting makes, just, you know, when you start training just after you've been lifting, everything just feels a little bit slow. Everything's not quite
I hate good. That feeling your reactions are delayed. Yeah, it makes you realize just how important timing is, because Yeah, as you said, after a day of heavy lifting, you're just that on that slight lag, and I notice my jiu-jitsu falls apart basically. I just become really crappy. Look, I would just say to anyone listening, if you are a lighter guy and you want to gain mass, following Ollie's protocol of drinking close to a gallon of chocolate milk a day and
May not
sticking
be
to the three
advisable.
basic lifts may not be advisable, but it fucking worked, bro. It worked for
Yeah,
you, that's
I
for
mean,
sure.
yeah. Again, I think to be fair, it was the fact it was that combined with, because I mean, again, on a bunch of fitness forums and stuff that I've been on, a lot of people just absolutely slate the gallon of milk a day things that will just get you fat. I mean, again, that's if you combine it with jujitsu a ton, that takes the edge off it. If you're just gonna go, well, I'm gonna work my desk job and go to the gym 3 days a week and drink a gallon of chocolate milk a day, you're going to get very fat very quickly. Because I mean, I gained 14 kilograms in 4 months. That's how
Wow.
much I gained. And again, I wasn't all good weight, but it wasn't all bad weight either.
I remember
I never got
you were still
fat.
pretty lean. Yeah, you
Yeah,
were
I
still
mean,
pretty
I didn't
lean.
have like a six pack or anything like that, but I never really gained bad weight. Obviously, generally science wise, at least half of it's going to be bad weight technically. But yeah, I never got too out of hand. I just basically became square. I think space description of what happened with me.
You're ridged, Ollie. Let's use
Yeah,
the correct term, please.
but yeah, so I just got kind of large. But it does work. You just need massive calorie excess. Maybe I overshot it, but again, I try. I had a terrible, terrible diet at that point, leaving aside the chocolate milk, and I gained no weight because you train jiu-jitsu, you're a little bit younger, your metabolism just carries you through it. If you're training for 10 times a week, if you didn't eat, if I ate healthily, I would have lost another 3 or 4 kilos and I'd have been down to like 70 or something like that.
Your diet used to make me cry. I remember I'd be leaving the gym on my
Necessary.
way to go get lunch or something. You'd be walking back and you'd be eating like the equivalent of a packet of M&Ms and a Coke. And I would just be like, dude, what are you doing to yourself?
Yeah, I grew out of that a little bit in the end, but yeah, I mean, it was a stage where you're training full time and your body has cravings, and so you just do it. And it was, yeah, I guess I never took it as I never came from sort of a background in sport where those things are really drilled in. Eventually, I did come around to doing that, and relatively now I eat a whole lot healthier than I did back then. But it never really. I never felt like it was severely impairing me, and you can point out to a whole ton of jiu-jitsu athletes who have slightly shaky diets just because their training regimen allows them for it. I think it was Leandro who did a little thing about his when he had to change his diet up because he was changing weight classes, that he had to stop drinking like a liter and a half of Coke a day or something like that. And you're just like,
Oh, that's
okay. And
interesting.
you got Kaio who's by all accounts, massively addicted to candy. You've got tons of very, very high level guys who have slightly shaky diets, and because of the nature of jiu-jitsu, they can kind of work around it. Is it optimal? Definitely not, but it's definitely something you can get away with, at least for quite a while. Not that I'd recommend it if you want to take things seriously now, particularly the vast majority of guys you're going to run into in competition are training like pro athletes, eating like pro athletes, supplementing everything. So if you want to compete on that level, you have to treat it like an athlete first, not just kind of what I did, which was, a hobby that I did full time that that kind of just worked out in some way. But so if you come from an
So
athletic background, it's different. Yeah.
you say a hobby that you did full time. I might have to disagree with you a little bit on that. I wanted to speak about your experience and your journey when it comes to jiu-jitsu. It was very framed by, and still is to an extent, framed by the amount of competing you did. I can't remember the figure. I'm hoping you do, but there was a point where you became the most prolific jiu-jitsu competitor in UK history or something like that, and you did X number of matches. Can you remember what
There was
that?
never like a specific way of testing these things, but I remember I'd had like 500, 600 matches by the time I was like, I think by brown belt or something like that.
That's pretty impressive, Ollie.
I competed a ton. I did. I was doing. I think at my most, I did. I think it's five competitions in a month once, which doesn't sound like much, but given there's only 4 weekends, there's only so much you can do there. I know I did one weekend where I did an amateur MMA competition on the Saturday and then took a coach to Paris and then fought a jiu-jitsu competition in Paris the day after.
Damn.
with and because it was amateur MMA, I'd fought a Thai boxing guy I'd never fought, so I turned up for my jiu-jitsu thing with my legs just completely wrecked, which was ideal. But a few things like that. But no, I competed because at the time, I just competed everything that I could, and at the time there weren't that many competitions in the UK, which is why I was traveling to Europe and other stuff. It was just what.
And what was the drive, Ollie? What was motivating you to compete like a madman?
I mean, it's kind of hard to examine, but basically when I started out, I still remember my second competition. My first competition was after 3 months. I went with some training partners up north and I got wrecked by somebody. I can't remember. I competed just random nostalgia. I found a picture of it way after, and I was competing in gi pants with my shirt off in a no-gi competition. So that's the kind of period we're talking about, right? I don't know what I was doing, but I just saw the picture, like, wow, those were simpler times. But yeah, so that was my first. My second competition, I asked my dad and my brother to show up, and I got wrecked in my first fight again. And then I somehow managed to pick up a silver in the absolute. And I remember my brother, who I'm actually staying with at the moment briefly, basically said, well, we were just expecting you to try really hard and then lose, which was a little bit harsh. But again, from his perspective, you know, as a guy, I've never done any sports, you know, at any kind of level prior to starting jiu-jitsu. That's pretty much what he thought. He thought I was going to try really hard and then lose, which is... didn't really work out that way, but once I'd gone full time with everything, I realized that I could win, I could compete, and I just felt that if I am going to do everything full time, it's going to be my living, and I'm committing my whole days, weeks, whatever to it, and I just stay at the academy and do nothing, then why am I doing it? You know, you should have, you know, some measure of it, and you know, maybe down the line. You can look back at it and just say, well, I competed everything I could. And you only have so many opportunities to single out, like, to have these achievements and things. If you skip competing and decide to compete for the first time at light brown, that'd be a good experience and it's okay. But, you know, you need to have that continuous testing if you want your level to go up, competitively speaking. Generally, some people just naturally compete incredibly well, but, yeah, I just felt that if I'm doing it full time, why not go and compete at these things? Why not try and build a resume, try to see what achievements I can put together? And each time, you know, given that I came from a place where I didn't expect to ever really do all that well. And again, that's what my brother said about me, but it's also true of myself. I never expected, when I won my first competition, which was a few months after that, I never could imagine actually winning a gold medal in a competition. It wasn't a big competition. There was like four guys. I'm not going to lie. The first time. But, you know, I was like, well, I just couldn't imagine ever winning a competition. I thought, okay, I'll compete. Maybe I'll beat this guy. But I never thought I could win something. And I did. And then for a long period, I won a lot of things. Never at like the super, super, super high level. But I managed to compete on a national and European level and do really, really well. Just through, you know, graft, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You just put the time in, and yeah. I find it really inspirational, Ali, because you said something to me once, always stuck with me. We were talking because you and I there are similarities between our respective journeys, and you once said that guys like you and I, we just have to work harder because we don't have that particular X factor physically when it comes to like the superstar guys, and I respect the hell out of you that you. I mean, for me, I know when I got to a point when I was like, look, I'm never going to be the world champion. I can just see these guys are just, I just don't have, as you said, that X factor didn't all come together for me. I kind of like lost interest, and you just kept going. And I always respected that. You just carried on competing and competing. I wanted to ask you specifically about, you know, one of the things I enjoy least about competitive jiu-jitsu and grappling is the nerves and the pre-competition jitters or anxiety. And I wanted to know if after you must be approaching close to 1,000 matches now, has that lessened or has it changed?
It depends. It's more about the individual on the other end. I mean, I've had competitions where I've literally, maybe I competed too much to the point where there was no nerves whatsoever, and so I didn't actually perform because I didn't have that sharpness and that edge that comes from the nerves. So I've had a couple of competitions where I'm just like I wasn't what you'd probably describe as present in the moment or whatever. You know, I was there and I was like, well, I'm fighting this guy, but I wasn't engaged in any real way. And I've lost matches because of that, and I've won matches like that. It depends. But I think if you compete a whole ton, sometimes, you know, you get a little bit jaded on the whole thing. Because yeah, you know, you don't, I mean, which is good because you don't get the nerves, but sometimes you need a little bit of those nerves to sharpen everything you do, you know, to mean that your grips are tighter, that you don't allow. I mean, I tend still to compete a little bit better than I roll, I think, because when I do have the nerves and I worry, I control grips better because I'm aware of the consequences of not doing that. You know, in training, you maybe you go 80% or 85%, and so as a result, you lose every battle that you have with someone who's going 100%. Whereas in competition, you're going 100%, so the battles last longer. And this is sort of, you know, figurative and literal, but you know, like the grip fights and everything else, you know, when you go because you know that if you don't, it's going to go horribly wrong. Whereas in training, sometimes you don't switch on, you don't pull the trigger, and as a result, you know, you get countered and things end up worse. This applies again, particularly in half guard, which is always going to be a fight. Again, in close guard, in spider guard, whatever, you can have a grip, you know, you can keep your control over it, and then when you're ready, you can go. Half guard, when you go, you have to commit to it completely because if you mess up, they're going to pass your guard because you're not starting generally with a complete guard. You know, you don't have as much control over their body. So if you go, then you know, you have to fight all the way to the finish. And if you stop halfway through in training, which happens to me sometimes, you know, a bigger, stronger, meaner guy will just deny you and end up in a dominant position, which you then have to get out of. Whereas in competition, you know, you're going to fight for everything because you're aware that if you mess up and if someone passes your guard, you're probably going to lose.
That makes sense to
You
me.
know, because, you know, a guard pass ends things the majority of the time. So, yeah, basically, the more you compete, the less nerves you get. That's true. But I think it just depends after a while on the nerves come from who you're fighting rather than the fact you are fighting.
That makes
So,
sense to me.
I mean, I fought JT Torres way back in Abu Dhabi a while back, and I just spent the whole fight going, I hope I don't get beat in like 35 seconds. Because again, it depends on the person's style. But JT is, you know, a phenomenal athlete, incredibly fast and very quick to punish any kind of mistakes. So I was thinking, I hope I don't pull guard, miss guard, have him take my back and choke me in like 35 seconds. Because that was entirely possible given what I knew of his game and whatever. And so that there you're worried about just getting absolutely killed. But then sometimes, you know, you fight somebody you don't really know, whatever. You're like, okay, I'm not going to look up this guy's, you know, previous fights or whatever. I'm just going to do what I do and see what happens. And so it will alternate a bit depending on who the person is. And that will determine a little bit how nervous you
That
are.
makes sense.
But yeah, in general, the more I've competed, the less nervous I've got. It's just about the event itself after a while. And again, at the same time, when you've competed, there's a brief refereeing tangent here, but when you've competed at a super high level, you know, everything else kind of in comparison, you're like, well, I've done this, I've done that. Why should I be worked up about this in comparison? You know, and I mean, I've been beaten horribly quickly. Again, I think the quickest I've been submitted in a match was 9 seconds. And that's happened a couple of times. Once Rafa Mendez, once was a guy called Mike Russell from the UK. You know, I've been beat horribly badly before, so
You've
hey,
also
and
beaten dudes horribly badly, if I remember correctly.
I have, but you know, I've had a couple of very, very fast wins. I think my fastest win was 7 seconds. You know, it goes both ways, but you know, I know I've lost horribly badly, and so it's not going to be like, oh, well, this has never happened before, because you know, I've been straight up killed by the first submission for the first movement of the entire fight. That's happened, so why stress about it? Relatively, it's just about, you know, hoping that particularly when you've traveled or you're at a big competition, that you can put on a performance that makes you know, that justifies the time you've taken to get there, the journey and everything. So if you're gonna, it's going out to California or whatever, fight the Pan Americans, and you know, you don't want to go out there and get beaten in a minute, you know, after you've spent time training for it, that you've spent all these hours and, well, traveling even, you know, given up a week to do it. So yeah, so things like that, you know, the bigger the event, the more you want to justify your attendance. But at the same time, again, you competed at the high level for a while. There's not a whole lot to worry about. Touch wood, I've never been, you know, hurt badly in competition or anything else. So I don't really worry about that quite so much. It's
That's cool.
Just hoping I can justify my attendance each time, I guess.
Fair enough. Well, Ollie, the last thing I wanted to touch on in today's conversation is probably the one thing you and I, the biggest thing you and I have in common, which is we've both had for the last several years, a pretty nomadic lifestyle. Both just been traveling and teaching jiu-jitsu in far-flung locations across the planet. And I wanted to know, I mean, the reason this is quite pertinent for me at this particular time is I'm now speaking to you from my house. It's the first house I've had in 5 years, and I'm really enjoying it. I'm thoroughly enjoying knowing, okay, that is my cupboard, that's where my clothes are, I have a kitchen, you know, this is my living room. I'm thoroughly enjoying being settled. And so the question I had for you is, are you approaching the end of this journey, or do you think you still have another few years left to go, and are you still enjoying it?
I think I have a couple more years. I think I kind of set the mark at like 35. I think that was a point where I was thinking, okay, I should be kind of having a plan at that point. But it's just, as it probably was in your case as well, it's that it doesn't really make sense to be in one place when you have all these obligations and, you know, opportunities that are international. Mm-hmm. So if you have your one place and you're never there, then what's the point? You know, that sounds, you know, obvious, but, you know, yeah. So if, cause I mean, right now I have like my association where I have, you know, four or five gyms that I travel around, and I'm at them for like a week at each of them. So that's already, you know, 8-10 weeks out of the year, I stay at those gyms and I teach and train everything from there. I have my refereeing stuff, I have traveling for competitions, I have seminars, and by the time all of those things happen, there isn't a whole lot of time to spend at home, really. And so it doesn't really make sense to have, you know, it'd be great to have a nice place, but it doesn't make sense to have it and never be there. So so I do the whole on the road thing, and that's worked out for me, you know, up until now. At some point, yeah, I will try and find a place where I spend more time and try to grow things, but I don't want to abandon or put down my, you know, the other obligations I have just for the sake of that. So again, for example, if my association thing keeps growing and I end up with 10-12 academies, then that's gonna account for traveling for 40 weeks out of the year. And so by the time you're doing that, how do you have time to grow your own individual base, your own academy, your own, you know, specific location that you teach at full time? You don't really. So you got to decide in the end, do you want to have a full-time place that you get to see grow, that you get to see the students come in and adjust and everything, or do you try to make it try to be part of something bigger on a global scale where, you know, you're going to a lot of different places, but you're not at each of them full-time? So it's a different kind of thing, and I haven't really decided still where I fall on that one. I think in the end, yes, staying in one place will be, you know, necessary or encouraged, but it's just not reached that stage. I mean, I'm very rarely still in one place for more than like a week at a time. So it's just how things are right now.
Do you not find that it's the thing that I've realized is, especially when it comes to my business, I didn't realize how much mental energy your brain is using to process the new environments you find yourself in, and the fact that, yeah, your things aren't in the same place and the bathroom's in a different place and the different cultural quirks that you have to adjust to. Here, having been settled for like just a month in my own place, I've freed up
that sense of certainty, and I get what you mean. I mean, it can be draining traveling the whole time, and you know, it means that when you've been doing it for a long time, like in one like full stint. I mean, I've had periods where, you know, I've traveled full time for, you know, 6 weeks or whatever, which doesn't sound like a lot, but that's from one place to another, mm-hmm. to another. And with different, sometimes with a competition thrown in, or, you know, and teaching and seminars and everything else. It can be draining, particularly because, it's more the social energy, I think, a little bit for me as well. Cause I'm not actually naturally a particularly extroverted person. I'm a bit more introverted. I need my own space sometimes. And when you are spending time with a lot of people, you can't, you can't really be that, and you can't be antisocial. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't spend time with somebody and say, I'm going to go to my room now, because then you become that guy who came over for a seminar and just stayed in his room the whole time. And you hear stories about, you know, various instructors, you know, who'll come over and everyone will just say, well, he just sat in his room and did nothing. And like, it depends on how you ended up there. But for some guys who are, you know, doing 5-6 weeks of seminars, I fully understand why people will go, well, like the whole gym says, do you want to go out for food? And they go, no, I'm going to stay back in my hotel room or whatever and do that. Again, I try to be outgoing and social, but again, once you've done a seminar, once you've done 4 hours of, you know, full connection, immersion, whatever, it's kind of hard sometimes to find the extra 3 or 4 hours of socializing afterwards. Mm-hmm.
That makes total sense to me.
It comes more naturally to certain people. I think, again, generally Brazilians are very, very good at that, more so than some other nationalities, just a more inherently outgoing social people. Generalization, but often mm-hmm. true, I think. Mm-hmm. So it's the drainingness of having to be outgoing when you're not naturally that way. Which is a little bit tiring when it's done for days upon days upon days. Mm-hmm. But that's pretty much the hardest part, and that's not really too bad in the scheme of things. And when it comes to all the opportunities and things, it's far easier to do all the traveling and stuff now, see the world, go to all these places, have all these opportunities, and then settle down after, than it is to do the
that's
opposite.
That's very, very you true. Know,
I,
yeah.
mean, I mean, there are exceptions. I mean, you hear about people, you know, like the couple who had regular jobs, had kids, and then decided they were going to take their kids on a boat trip around the world or something like that. You know, they were going to grow up visiting different cities. That's both incredible and a little bit scary, but I think it's much easier to do it the way that I have done it. And so, you know, there's people you run into who, you know, in the States particularly, but other places who have a passport, who've never had a passport, never left the country.
Yeah, it's wild.
And they've been there for years and years and years. And so the fact I've had the opportunity to go practically anywhere in the world, and not just go there, but to go there and do things and be part of events, is something you can't really put a value or a price on. So as long as there's things to do and there's opportunities to get by traveling, I'm going to keep on doing it.
Fair enough.
That's pretty much my main approach there.
Nice. Ollie, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I'm always reminded after interacting with you just how smart you are and how deep of a thinker you are and how much you reflect on everything you do and everything you're involved in. So thank you for sharing your wisdom with us. If the people, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of them who have listened to this, want to contact you or find out more about you and where you're going to be and what you're doing, where should they go?
I think the easiest one usually, again, Facebook. If you search Oliver Geddes, I had an athlete page, but I got rid of it in the end. But there's still a regular page. You can follow that. You can try a friend request, but it's kind of stacked up with a whole lot of people from around the world now. Instagram, Oliver Geddes. I gave up on, you know, having cool trendy nicknames and decided to use my real name. So just if you search it, and there's OliverGeddes.com, which again has links to all the same things. That's pretty much where it's at. Instagram and Facebook, and everything on Instagram gets cross posted to Facebook anyway. So that's sort of my updates. I kind of fell off social media a little bit for the past month and a bit. I just fell behind on updating everyone. So I'm currently in a kind of doing a post a day thing on Instagram, updating on what I've been doing the past few weeks. But it's always hard to choose what to focus and what to highlight. You're just like, I don't want to just try and, you know, okay, here's everything I've been doing, but you try and find the individual things that are worth a post where you're like, okay, this is what I've been doing, and, you know, it was amazing, basically.
Great, great. Cool, Ollie. Thanks for everything, bud, and I look forward to seeing you when our paths cross somewhere in the world. It's probably going to have to be in the US. Yes. I think it's going to be in the US because...
Well, I'll be over there, don't worry.
Yeah, and I have no doubt about that.
I may not be in Arizona, but we'll see. Cool. If you're okay with me exposing your location to the world, you're okay with that, right?
Peace out, Ollie.
Okay, peace out. Take care. Have a good one.
It never ceases to amaze me just how smart Ollie is. You know, he did a degree in computer science at a pretty prestigious university in the United Kingdom. And when you interact with the guy in person as well, you can just sense that he is mentally very adept, and he's chosen to focus all that mental energy and intelligence on jiu-jitsu, and it shows because, I mean, he's thought about everything. He's thought about every single aspect of the art, including not just the stuff on the mat, but you will not find anyone who knows more about the competition scene or the gossip in jiu-jitsu or the social scene. He's a prolific, or he's done a lot of refereeing for the IBJJF. He's just fully immersed himself in this field of study. And it's, for me, fascinating to see what happens when a mind like that is put to the task of that full immersion when it comes to something specific, and just how specialized it can become. And that, to me, is what Ollie is in a nutshell. I consider it a great, great privilege to know him and to have trained with him and to be able to talk to him and share his wisdom. I hope you guys enjoyed that show. Another cool one coming next week. Peace out.